When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we are joined by marine biologist Carly Jackson to talk about her work as a shark scientist and about her new book, Sharks: What Do Great Whites, Hammerheads, and Whale Sharks Get Up To All Day? Welcome to the show, Carly.
Hi, Christina. Nice. Very excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited that you're here and for everything you're going to share with us today. Before we dive into the book, will you please tell us about yourself?
Yes. So my name is Carly Jackson Bohannon. I just added the Bohannon like about 8 months ago, got married. So I am a marine biologist. I study sharks and sea turtles. So I kind of get the best of both worlds. And I am currently working as the director of communications for an organization called Minorities in Shark Sciences, or MISS for short. It's an organization that I actually co-founded. So I am one of the founders, and I work with our communications, doing a lot of the marketing, social media, and communicating with donors and things like that. I am really passionate about sharks. I joke and say that sea turtles kind of pay the bills. They've historically paid my bills, and that's how I got into sea turtles and everything. But sharks are something I've been super passionate about for as long as I can remember. And I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan, actually, and grew up accessing the ocean through books and things like that. So I moved to Florida for my undergrad, and I've been in Florida ever since because I hate being cold and I'm never going back to live in the cold. But yeah, so that's just a little bit about me.
Thank you for that. You shared about what got you into this, but how did you know this was a field to go into? How did you know this was going to lead to a job for you?
So I'll be honest, I had no idea when I was younger that you could really do it as a job. I just remember seeing it on TV and I was like, I guess a marine biologist is on TV all the time, like doing stuff with sharks and being on boats. So I didn't really get a good look at what the job, you know, like what I could be until maybe like high school, around that time where I was trying to figure out where I wanted to go to college and things like that. So I didn't really have a specific job in mind growing up, and there, like, all I knew was I wanted to work with sharks, and I was like, at some point it's gonna happen. I don't know what I'll be doing, but I know it'll be with sharks.
Did you find a mentor in a college professor who pointed you towards a career studying sharks?
So I kind of have a non-traditional way of getting into this field because I wasn't guided very well coming into this field. So all I knew was, like I said, I knew I wanted to work with sharks. I went to college that had a good marine biology program, but I still didn't really have much guidance. How I got into sharks was reading a book on sharks when I was six. That's really how, that's what captivated me. I read this book and I was just like, sharks are the coolest things and I want to be a shark scientist. So after that, that's really when I started being more serious about like reading lots of books on sharks and really getting into it. But in regards to like mentors or anything, I really didn't get any of my own mentors until grad school, around that time. So after I'd graduated from undergrad and really was like trying to figure out what the next step was and how I would really get to that next step. I got a really good mentor the summer after I graduated from undergrad. And then in undergrad is when I started getting a lot more mentors that would help me kind of shape the pathway that I wanted to go into, and really encouraged me and gave me a lot of good advice and really pushed me in this career.
Was that part of what led you to be so passionate about mentoring other young people coming up, that this could be a field for them?
Yes, for sure. So one of the things that my organization does, MISS, we focus on really making shark science an accessible field for gender minorities of color, because this is a field that has just historically we've been very underrepresented. Like, as a Black woman, I came into this field and didn't see myself reflected in this field at all, and really didn't meet any other Black woman in the field until I was about to graduate from grad school. So that entire time, I had never really connected with, you know, other mentors or just other peers and things like that. But that's definitely, like, my own journey is what gave me the passion to really help others along the journey, so that it would be a lot easier for them. And so they had, you know, providing them with resources that I didn't have coming up in this field. And that's really what has made me very passionate about, like, mentoring and trying to make this field more accessible for other people that look like me.
Minorities in Shark Sciences has a book, and I recently got it, and I've had a chance to take a peek, and it touches on this. There's many chapters that talk a lot about sharks, but there's also sections about how to be an ally, about change that needs to happen in the field altogether. And in the opening, it says that it was a very white male field. It's not a meritocracy. And if you want to do something and there aren't people doing it who look like you, that's a sign that it's not a meritocracy.
Yeah. So it's like, our biggest thing is, you know, that whole book, the theme of it was inclusive research. So having, you know, collaborating on different things that with like-minded people and with people that look like you, because it's like you said before, it's a very white male dominated field, and it's still it was historically, and it still is getting better now, but it's still dominated by that demographic. And doing things like that book, which is bringing together all different types of gender minorities of color, and showing, you know, that representation, that there are different people in this field. It's not only a white male demographic in this field. There's more than that. So that was the big thing with the book, was, you know, other minorities of color, or gender minorities of color, coming together and sharing their research and saying, like, we're out here doing this research too.
And in many different parts of the world, I had a chance to read through the bios of some of the contributors, and they're from all different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And they share the common concern about sharks and their habitat and conservation and overfishing.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not, you know, we tend to think that America is the center of everything, but there's just, you know, there's so much research happening around the world by the people that are indigenous to those lands, or, you know, people that actually live there. And there's a lot that we can learn from those researchers. And instead of us going into those countries and doing that research, just letting, you know, the natives of that land actually, or the people that live there, do the research, that is, that's a really big thing in this field. And just, you know, being able to allow those researchers to share their research in that book, I think is really cool, and really spreads that message that, you know, there's lots of good research and lots of different research happening all around the world. And these people also care about sharks. It's not just us that cares about the sharks. It's everyone that benefits from, you know, them being in their ecosystem.
Will link information about that book to the show notes. I want to turn now to your book, Sharks, A Day in the Life, which was published by Neon Squid. You referenced earlier that your first book on sharks, you were 6 years old, and it changed the whole path of your life. How did you get connected up with Neon Squid to create this project for them?
So it's just a really funny story, and just overall ironic how I came to writing a book on sharks, and that's how I got into shark science. But Neon Squid actually contacted me because I believe someone heard me on a podcast like this. Someone either heard me on a podcast or saw me on a video somewhere, and they were like, oh, like she seems like someone who's fun, who would be good to write this book. And apparently they had been looking for a shark expert to, or shark scientist to write this book. And they reached out to me to see if I would be interested at all. And I definitely never saw myself as an author or even like ever writing a book. So I was just like, I guess I'll see how it is or, you know, just see what you have to offer and go from there. But they reached out to me. We had a meeting. And once I learned more about the process of writing the book and other books that they've done before, I just thought it was really cool and jumped to the opportunity.
And the introduction in the book really tells us about your mission of public education that you've shared already, but it really comes through that you want other girls who are now like you were when you were six, looking around for books and wondering who gets to study these things, to know it's them. They get to study these things. The book takes us through an entire day. It starts at 8 in the morning and goes all the way until 11 o'clock at night. And each double page spread introduces us to another shark. I'm curious how you narrowed down which sharks you wanted to include. You tell us early on there are over 500 different known species of sharks, and more work still needs to be discovered about how many species there really are. How do you narrow that down into a 48-page book?
Oh my gosh, that was the hardest thing, I would say. Well, one of the hardest things was narrowing it down, but the easiest part for narrowing it down was the fact that there are some species that are not exactly, there's some species that are just not as quote unquote popular as the other ones. So, you know, like everyone knows what a great white shark is. Everyone knows what like a tiger shark is. Like, you know, those species that you hear on the news or that you see on Shark Week or Shark Fest, but I really wanted to focus on species that were, you know, that didn't have as much love as those big charismatic species. So I chose species that people either wouldn't have really heard of before or just species that aren't talked about that might just be glossed over. And I also wanted to choose species that had very unique roles in the environment and like little niches that they fit into that I thought would be cool for kids and really everyone to learn. So that's how the process of narrowing it down definitely was difficult, but I do specifically remember them asking me to like, oh, like, can you include this species? Or like, can you include this one, like a tiger shark? And I was like, you know, I want to put species in here that no one's ever heard of, that you look at the shark and you're just like, what is that? What is that? And you learn something completely new about that shark and are just, because like I said, that's how I got excited about sharks. I learned about something that I had absolutely no idea about, found out how absolutely amazing and just like awesome sharks were. And that's what got me excited. So that was my goal with narrowing down those species, was to give you all something that you might not have, give you a species that you might not have heard of before, and also learn about like why that species is even important in that environment.
The Neon Squid series is technically written for children, but like all good nonfiction children's books, it's a great starter book for adults who are curious about a topic they don't know much about. And this book has a wonderful glossary and it has amazing illustrations. It's rare when the author gets to talk directly to their illustrator. Did you send photos or how did you work with them to make sure that the details were accurate?
So I definitely sent photos as I was, like I said, the process of writing the book was really, I won't say easy. It was very, is collaborative. So I gave them spreads, then they would give me feedback. And then I would send, like after writing what a shark was going to do, I would send pictures of what I thought would be appropriate for, you know, what that shark would do. So I definitely had to send them a lot of pictures of different sharks and, you know, say like what I wanted the shark to be doing. And then they would send me back drafts or sketches and I would just approve them or say like, hey, like you're missing a gill or like you're missing a fin here or like a marking here. So yeah, it was really cool to be able to collaborate and work with the illustrator and really see my ideas come to life, because once I started seeing like the full spreads that were just full color, like the illustration in here is just absolutely beautiful. Like it's just, I love it. And it's like it's cartoony but also realistic, and it's just, the colors pop, and I absolutely am in love with the illustration in this book, and I think she did an amazing job bringing to life all the ideas I had in my head, because like literally every single spread is exactly what I had in my head when I was sending them the pictures. So that was really cool.
They are definitely frameable art. One thing that comes through is they each have their own distinct anatomy, even though they are all sharks. So I can see why you had to give specific notes, because someone who's not a shark scientist wouldn't know those finer details. And yet they are so beautifully rendered. You let us know in the book that sharks live all over the world. Have you been able to travel to various places and meet any of these sharks?
Yeah, some definitely. I guess I wouldn't say I've been able to travel all over the world to see these sharks. That's still a goal of mine, like to see like an epaulette shark in the wild or a whale shark out in the wild. But I've definitely traveled mostly within the Caribbean and seen hammerhead sharks. I've seen my fair share of lemon sharks, bull sharks. But the hammerhead sharks are definitely one of my favorites to go see because they're just like so majestic. But it's on my bucket list to see great white sharks and whale sharks in the wild. They occasionally come around here in Florida, but they're not like frequent. They don't like this isn't somewhere that they regularly live. They kind of just pass through. But but yeah, it's definitely a goal of mine to travel more and see more sharks that I wouldn't be able to see in my own backyard.
The book opens at 8 a.m. off the coast of Ireland with a basking shark, which you tell us is slow and as big as a truck. At 9 a.m., we go to the Bahamas where there are hammerheads. Since hammerheads are one of your favorites, do you want to talk to us about them?
Yes, for sure. So hammerheads, they are... It's funny because they're one of my favorites to swim with, for sure. I wouldn't say they're probably my top five species, but they're definitely one of my favorites to swim with because they are just so majestic. And I say that a lot, like all sharks are majestic, but the hammerhead in particular, the great hammerhead, they can get up to like 15 plus feet long. They've got these huge heads that can see almost 360 degrees. So their eyes are on the sides of their head on that hammer, which is called a cephalofoil, which I think I also mentioned in the book. But they also have this dorsal fin that is about as tall as they are deep. if that makes sense. So like their dorsal fin is like one of the biggest in all species because it's just so tall. And that is what distinguishes great hammerheads from a lot of different other species and other hammerhead species as well. But in the book, I talk about the hammerhead as hunting for its favorite prey, which is stingrays. So all sharks have these sensory organs in their face called ampullae of Lorenzini, and it allows them to detect electrical fields in the water. So hammerheads in particular, they have these organs spread out across their cephalofoil, or that hammer part of their head. And it's spread out, so it makes them more efficient in using that. And so it's literally, I also say this in the book, but they're literally a living metal detector. So they use that head to scan around on the sand, and they're looking for that prey that might be buried under the sand, which is what the stingray was in the book. It's buried under the sand. And the hammerheads also specialize in eating stingrays because they have these small mouths like at the bottom of their head, and they use their head to pin the stingray down, and then they just kind of like eat it like while it's pinned down, because they have those their mouth is right up under their head, so even though they're using their head to pin the stingray down, they're still able to eat the stingray like that. So I just think the way they hunt and all their quote unquote superpowers, I just think it's really cool.
At 10 a.m., we meet the shortfin mako shark, who you tell us is the fastest shark in the world. And at 11 a.m., we meet the lemon shark in the mangrove forest. That sounds like it's right in your neighborhood. Do you want to tell us about that part?
Yes. So I'll note that mako sharks are my third favorite shark ever because they are the fastest sharks in the world. And I was a competitive swimmer growing up and all through college. So I was like, I relate. Like, I think you're cool because you're a fast swimmer. And I was a fast swimmer too. but that and the lemon sharks definitely are in my backyard. So the mangroves, we have mangrove forests. You know, usually if you live on a coast, there are lots of mangroves, and especially in Florida and the Caribbean, we've got lots of mangrove trees. And mangrove trees are these trees that live like halfway in the water, so their roots are in the water. They live in brackish water, so salty water, not completely salt water, but it's salty fresh water pretty much. And mangroves, they have these, or specifically red mangroves, they have these roots that look like stilts coming out of them, and they're just like standing in the water pretty much. And mangroves are really important for a lot of coastal communities because those roots help keep the sand together and prevent erosion. And mangroves also help slow down a lot of wave action from hurricanes and like just large wave events. So they protect the coast. The mangroves protect the coast, they protect the coast and they protect the animals that are also in the water with them. So mangroves are also nursery grounds. So a lot of baby sharks and baby fish hang out in the mangroves because those roots provide a lot of hiding places from larger predators. So mangroves just overall have such an important role in our environment. Like, they protect us and they protect a lot of the baby fish and the baby sharks. So lemon sharks in particular, they are very frequently found in the mangroves. The mama lemon sharks, they give birth near the mangrove so that the baby lemon sharks can just go straight in there, and they'll be completely protected because sharks, they do start off as babies. They're small. They don't start off as like these apex predators. So they also are going to need that protection. So the lemon sharks heavily use the mangrove areas for protection from a lot of larger fish. Like, big barracuda could probably go after a lemon shark. So they like to hang out in those areas to stay protected. But there's a lot of research on lemon sharks and baby lemon sharks and like their social interactions and really how they use those mangroves. And I think it's really cool. And I was really happy to include those in the book because the picture in the book, actually, the illustration was inspired from a colleague of mine. She takes pictures of lemon sharks in mangroves, and she has this beautiful picture of this lemon shark among the roots in the mangroves in the water. And I was just like, that's so pretty. I have to have that in the book. So that's where that picture was inspired from. But yeah, it's definitely mangrove environments are just very important. And I was definitely wanted to make sure to include that in the book.
You mentioned earlier that it's on your bucket list to see epaulette sharks in the wild. And at 3 p.m., we meet them in Australia. I had never heard of them before. The book introduces me to so many things I never heard of before, which you said was your goal, and it comes through. Can you tell us about these walking sharks?
Yes, and it makes me so excited that you had never heard of them before and you were introduced to them through the book. But yeah, epaulette sharks, my second favorite sharks, because they're so cute. And I'm sure the book also kind of exuded that cuteness with the epaulette shark. But they're these small sharks that have this incredible superpower that allows them to stay out of water for a very long time, like up to an hour, I believe, they can stay out of the water. And you know, sharks, they're fish pretty much, and they need the water to breathe. But what's really cool about epaulettes, and I don't think I go into detail in the book, but I'll go into slight detail with this podcast. But they actually are able to secrete a chemical in their brain that shuts down parts of their brains that they don't need. So if they don't need the part of the brain that, like, you know, needs oxygen for breathing, then they'll just shut that down. And then they basically only use the essential functions of their brain to be able to walk around. And they're essentially holding their breath the whole time. So being able to shut down parts of their brains makes it so they don't need as much oxygen. So that's what allows them to function out of the water like that. And that's another way that they will hunt. So when the tides get low in those tide pools and the epaulettes come out and they are hunting, they usually will hunt in those tide pools because their prey is trapped in those little pools and they can't really get out. They can't swim away. So the epaulettes just will walk right over there and, you know, just be able to get their prey in a lot easier way. They won't really have to chase their prey. It's just right there in a on a platter, pretty much, in that tide pool. But, and I always think it's funny, like, we're describing an epaulette walking, but it's really, like, think of, like, a salamander, like, trying to walk. That's really how epaulettes look. It's not, like, a very graceful thing. They're kind of just almost slithering. Looks sort of like a snake, but the best way I can describe it is like a salamander. But that's really how they move, is like a salamander, and they have these pectoral fins. That's the side fins on the sharks, and they're really flexible, and their pecs are also a little muscular, so that's how they're able to use them to kind of push themselves off the rocks and just use them to push themselves off the rocks, there we go, and like slither a little bit across the tide pools. So they're really cool sharks. They're super cute, and they're a smaller species of shark too. They're like, they can maybe get up to like a little bit more than a foot, like 2 feet maybe. But that's another thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, is that most sharks are like 5 feet or less. Most shark species only can get up to like 5 feet. And not all sharks are these huge, giant great whites or tiger sharks. And a lot of the sharks species are small guys. So we gotta appreciate the small guys.
We do get a sense of what different body types they have and their different skills and their different diet that they eat. But one of the other things the book highlights is they even have different breathing techniques. You just told us how the epaulette shark can hold their breath for an hour, which, as a swimmer, I'm super impressed. I would love to be able to hold my breath longer than I can. But with the nurse shark, they have a completely different breathing technique, even than that. Can you talk about the nurse shark?
Yes. So the nurse shark is my number one favorite. I love how we kind of went from 3-2-1 in my favorite sharks. But the nurse shark is my absolute favorite shark. I am a little bit biased because they were my study animal in my thesis. So that's why I love them so much. But they're also just like really cute and they just like chill at the bottom. But nurse sharks, they have this type of breathing called buccal pumping. And there's a few other shark species that also have this type of breathing, but mostly in like the Atlantic, like the West Atlantic, the nurse sharks are one of the few that actually will be able to buccal pump. And buccal pumping is when they use their cheek muscles to suck in water and pass it through their gills. Now, most shark species are what we call ram ventilators. And that is when you have to keep swimming to get that water to pass through your gills. So, you know, you might have heard that if a shark stops swimming, it'll die. That's true for some sharks, but not all. And since the nurse shark is not a ram ventilator, they buccal pump, they're able to just rest at the bottom. So they'll sit at the bottom under this coral and just use their cheek muscles to suck in the water and pass it through their gills. They also have a secondary breathing that really, they don't really use it for breathing. It's more for clearing food while they're eating. But it's a little hole on their head and it's called a spiracle. So it's also connected to like breathing and everything and getting oxygen, but it's mostly used for like clearing food. But yeah, so nurse sharks, they also use that buccal pumping to eat. So they have got like one of the fastest prey captures of any species, which means that they can, as soon when they see their prey, they'll just suck it up and it's gone. So they'll use their cheek muscles to just suck up the prey and just crush it with their teeth. And they do this usually with like lobsters or crab or like a conch. So like a conch shell, they can crush that with their teeth and they can just like suck up the conch from inside the shell, which I think is pretty cool. And I think I've read a paper saying that their suction force was like as strong as like 7 vacuums or something, 7 of those really strong vacuums. So nurse sharks are, fun fact, also one of the worst sharks to ever get bit by, because even though they look like they've got like a small mouth, it's because of that buccal pumping. They can suck on to whatever they're biting and they can just not let go if they don't want to. And I've tagged a couple of nurse sharks. So in my research, I do some field work with some collaborators and we've tagged some nurse sharks. And there have been times where we have hooked a nurse shark, but it wasn't actually hooked in its jaw. You pull it all the way up and the whole time it's just hanging onto the hook. Like it just has the hook in its mouth. Like it's not actually hooked in the side of its mouth. It's just holding on to it. So that is how strong their suction force and like their bite force is. So, well, not exactly bite force, but just that's how strong their grip is. And if you get bit by a nurse shark, usually it's something that you did and you just like irritated it and it bit you. That's usually how nurse shark bites go. They're provoked and then they'll bite. And if that happens, usually like it is just, it's very, very hard to get the shark off because they have just sucked on and kind of just clamped on. So definitely one of the worst sharks to get bit by. Thankfully, I've never gotten bitten. I know someone who did get bit by a small nurse shark. But yeah, they are feisty little things, but I love them. And I made sure to put lots of nurse sharks in this book because they're my favorite.
We do meet them twice. We meet them around 2 o'clock or around 1 o'clock in Belize. And then we come back to them at 8 o'clock because they're nocturnal. you introduce us to the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef, which is the second largest reef in the world. Is that one of the places you've gone to visit?
Yes. So nurse sharks were, I think I said this earlier, they were my study animal for my thesis. And I actually went to Belize. I stayed in Belize for 2 months to study the nurse sharks there. So that is where that reference comes from. So the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef, like right off of that reef is where I was doing most of my research. I was looking at the effects of tourism and like feeding tourism on the nurse sharks there. But yeah, so that's where that reference comes from.
People don't encroach in this story very often, but we do have snorkelers who disturb a shark and the shark has to move. And we also see people again at 5 o'clock in the section called Hook, where the marine biologists are studying a short fin mako shark. Why did you choose only to bring people in twice? I know you're very concerned about shark habitats.
Yeah, so I had to make sure to, bring in people so that we can see those shark-human interactions, because it is something that, you know, might not happen super often, but it happens. And I wanted to make sure that was portrayed in the book, you know, like a realistic situation. Why would a nurse shark even move from the place that it's napping? Probably because a human was snorkeling and it got startled. And I didn't want to make it seem like, oh, it was a bad thing that this human like came around and was snorkeling and scared the nurse shark. Like, it's just something that happens. And I just thought it was important to include that. And also, especially in the spread called Hook, where we are introduced to scientists, I thought that that was very important to show to all audiences, because shark science is something that you might not know exactly all the inner workings of it. Like, why are they doing this? How do they even tag a shark? And like, what are they using? What are the different equipment that they're using? So I wanted to make sure to include that in the book so that people have a little bit of an idea of how shark science might work and what a field workup would look like. And also showing that the shark scientists are also concerned about, you know, the well-being or the welfare of the animal, and not just like, oh, like we've got this shark on the side of the boat and we're just going to do all these things without even caring about the shark might be breathing or not. So I just wanted to make sure to include that in the book. And also, if you'd notice, a lot of the representation and the scientists are, you know, people of color, and I wanted to make sure that was represented in the book so that other kids would be able to, you know, see themselves represented in the book.
You mentioned earlier that you had done tagging, and in the section called Hook, we see how they're doing that. For listeners, can you describe what that process is?
Yes. So the tagging that I personally do, I don't use like satellite tags, but for the most part, it is a similar process. So in the book, it is a mako shark that's getting tagged with a satellite tag so that they can follow her movement and all that good stuff. And the process that they the whole workup process is very similar to what I do out in the field. So they take blood, they took measurements, and they I think they also took like other samples, and that's exactly what I do in the field. So we'll go out, we'll set hooks, we'll do what's called like just scientific shark fishing. And once we do get an animal, depending on the boat that I'm on, like each boat kind of does it a little different, but sometimes if it's a really big shark, you'll put it on a platform that's in the water while everyone goes and restrains the shark. And then you make sure that the shark's able to breathe by putting a PVC pipe in the mouth and then turning on the water flow. So it's a PVC pipe that is it's almost like a pacifier for the shark. So it gives them something to bite on, and there's water flow through it, so it's allowing them to breathe. So during that time, we'll take measurements. We'll take what's called a fin clip sample, where you just cut off a tiny piece of what's called a trailing end of their dorsal fin, which is equivalent to us cutting off a fingernail, so it just grows back. And we use that to look at genetic information. We also take blood from the shark. We use that to look at, you know, any different physiological things with the shark, like stress hormones, other hormones, and just like bacteria, things like that. We also take what's called a biopsy. So just like if you went to the dermatologist and they had to biopsy you, we would also take a biopsy from the shark, and we use that sample to look at what's called stable isotope analysis, which is looking at using a bunch of different chemistry to see where in the food chain the shark might fall. So it kind of helps us see what the shark has been eating, what type of prey it's been eating. You can see if the prey might change during different seasons. But yeah, every sample that we take has a purpose, is trying to answer some type of question about the shark. And yeah, it's very similar to what was portrayed in the book. Now, in the book, they use a satellite tag. I usually use what's called like dart tags, which are just little tags that are just pieces of plastic, pretty much, that you stick in the shark. Satellite tags are like thousands of dollars, so it's not something that's regularly used. Usually, you only have like two or three that you put on certain sharks that you're trying to look at their movement. And satellite tags are mostly used for pelagic sharks. So sharks like the Mako shark, which are open water species. So species that just live out in the open ocean, don't really come anywhere near land, and just live their entire lives out in the open ocean. And satellite tags are the easiest or the best way to really study those animals and where they move, how they migrate, and things like that. But definitely was very happy to include that piece in the book and to show everyone that, you know, this is what shark science is, and it's really cool. And, you know, this, we're still trying to learn a lot about sharks, and there's still a lot that we don't know.
The book has, in addition to taking us through a long day that starts at 8 a.m. and ends at 11 p.m., it also has several double page spreads that take us through distinct things about sharks. One is the spread that takes us through their anatomy, and it shows us the different kinds of fins that you've been describing throughout our time together today. There's also a spread that compares different shark teeth. And then there's another one that compares different types of shark skin that different species of shark have that are very different from each other. When we get to 11 p.m., we meet an extremely unusual shark. And I know we're running out of time, but I have to ask you about the cookie cutter shark and its bioluminescence.
Yes, definitely wanted to include that one because they are, one, kind of creepy looking. I won't lie. They're very creepy looking. But also, it's probably a shark that you've never heard of before, and that, you know, is just something where you're just like, what is that? It's also a small shark, like very, very small, like maybe like a foot at the most is how big that they get. But the cookie cutter shark is something out of nightmares. And it's a shark that lives in the deep ocean, but then comes up out of the deep ocean at night to feed on mammals, mostly like marine mammals, or really a large animal in the ocean. And they take, the reason why they're called the cookie cutter shark is because they literally take like perfect round chunks out of animals. And I've actually been to the fish store before, and like a fish market, and I've seen fish that have a perfectly like a circular hole in the side of them. And that's literally from a cookie cutter shark, which is just crazy to see in a fish market sometimes. But yeah, these sharks go up and they just take these huge chunks out of animals, and that is how they feed. That is their, that is how they get their food. And they don't really, at least I don't from what I know, I don't believe they like hunt in schools, and it's like a piranha going at a dolphin, and just like they're taking chunks out of the dolphin. But usually it's just like one shark that'll go up, and that's just how they feed, is taking these chunks out of animals. And it's definitely creepy. And you know, because they are these deep ocean sharks, they have what's called bioluminescence, and their body can glow. It's just like a biological phenomenon that they are able to glow. And a lot of deep ocean sharks have that ability to glow. But the cookie cutter, it's also a way to like lure prey. So if you're just out swimming around and you see like a bright light, you are probably going to start swimming towards that light. And that's how the cookie cutter will like lure its prey to them and then take their chunks.
You tell us in the opening of the book that you feel they are very misunderstood animals, and that they are intelligent creatures, and they're clearly your favorite animals. While you have the listeners' attention, what are a few misconceptions and myths you'd like to clear up about these misunderstood animals in the few minutes we have left?
Yeah, so I guess the first one is the most obvious one, is that the myth is that sharks are out to get us, and they are hunting humans, and they like the taste of us. But that is completely false. Sharks, evolutionarily, they have been designed to eat specific things within their environment. So like whether that be seals, dolphins, or like smaller fish or crustaceans, things like that, we've historically never been on the menu. And most shark attacks you hear about, it's a shark that is biting and leaving the area, and not a shark that's actually consuming a person, because we really don't taste good to them. they don't think we taste good. So sharks are not out to get us, and the majority of attacks that happen are due to either like bad visibility, so the shark can't really see what you are, so they'll just take a bite to see what you are, and then they'll be like, oh, that is not exactly what I thought you were, so I'm gonna go somewhere else. But that's unfortunate for us, because if a big shark takes a bite, even if it's just a taste, that usually doesn't end well for us. But yeah, shark attacks mostly happen because of mistaken identity. That is the main thing that that's like the, yeah, mistaken identity is the similar factor in all most shark attacks. And another myth that I believe needs to be told is that the megalodon is 100% extinct. The myth is that it is still alive, like hiding somewhere in the deep trenches, but that is a myth. It is actually extinct, because if it were extant, it would probably be decimating a lot of our whale populations. But yeah, those are just like the two myths I could think of off the top of my head.
What do you wish humans would do differently?
What I wish that humans would do differently when it comes to sharks is to not lead with fear, and to lead more with like understanding, and not always come at sharks from a fear perspective, and come at it more from a more knowledgeable perspective. So for example, in a lot of like news outlets, like the headline will be like shark attacks surfer, or deadly shark does this body surfer and knocks him off this thing, and it's just all fear mongering. So just the entire you know, like sharks have this bad stigma because a lot of the media will paint them as these, you know, evil creatures. But I think that we can do a better job with giving sharks a better name, not a bad name, because you know, it's, you know, we we don't really, like, our perspective on sharks won't 100% affect their conservation, but, you know, it's their laws trying to be passed that protect sharks. And if people have this negative stigma or negative stereotype around sharks, it'll be harder to try and protect them and harder to really push for their conservation. So I think that we need to do a better job with leading with facts and not with fear, and also just educating, being open to the education about sharks. So I think, like, you know, networks like Shark Week need to do a little bit better, because a lot of their shows are fear-mongering, talking about, like, shark attacks, or talking about how, like, absolutely powerful these sharks are and, like, their bites and everything. But that's really, that's not all that sharks are about. Sharks are creatures that fit into specific niches in their environment. They're extremely important for our environment, and I think that we need to do a better job at communicating that. So yeah.
What do you hope this episode sparks for listeners?
Well, I hope that this episode sparks listeners to look more into sharks, to kind of pursue your own quote-unquote research when it comes to sharks. And hopefully you've also read my book, and I hope that that has sparked an interest in sharks and sparked an interest to dig deeper into certain species I might have talked about. But yeah, I really hope that after listening, people kind of have a different perspective on sharks, and also a different perspective on myself as a scientist, because a lot of people think scientists are, you know, these really boring, like, stuffy people, but that's not me. And that's not all scientists either. So yeah.
Thank you so much for being here today, Carly Jackson, and telling us about sharks and taking us through a day in their life. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, and you've been listening to The Academic Life on New Books Network. I hope you will please join us again.